The pain from Dallas to Nairobi today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. We often talk on The World about how other nations deal with violence. Today we focus on the U.S. and the shootings of police in Dallas.
Some people were yelling that officers were down. So as civilians are running backwards, officers are running towards the line of fire.
We also will be talking about police shootings of African-American men. This activist says you can do something about that, like learning more about your local government.
It is actually your local government that makes these decisions that determine whether or not policies are put in place to protect civilians.
Plus, a view from Brazil and Kenya, two countries also dealing with police-related violence. It's all coming up today here on The World. This show covers a lot of ugly stuff around the globe, war and refugees, terrible levels of violence, and we see all too often how one act of violence can lead to another. We still don't know all of the facts, but it looks like that's what happened last night in Dallas with the shooting of 12 police officers. Dallas Police Chief David Brown told a news conference this morning that Dallas officers are hurting. We are heartbroken, he said. But he insisted that the proper response to last night's deadly shooting is not to militarize police tactics.
We had an adequate amount of officers at this scene, and we were blocking traffic and doing all the things to protect people's right to protest and their free speech. We are not going to let a coward who would ambush police officers change our democracy.
The shooting took place at a rally in downtown Dallas. People had come out to protest police violence. Earlier, I spoke with Hannah Wise from the Dallas Morning News. She was at the protest last night when the shooting started and described the scene.
Yeah, so I'd been with the protesters for about 2 hours. First when they were rallying together, and then while they were marching through the streets of downtown Dallas. At the end of their march, they were getting ready to kind of have a second wind, and they got about a block and a half down the road when shots rang out. And people began running back, saying, like, they're shooting, they're shooting. Some people were yelling that officers were down. So as civilians are running backwards, officers are running towards the line of fire.
It sounds pretty chaotic. And this was right in downtown Dallas, yeah?
Yes, it's right in downtown Dallas. A lot of people may know about Dealey Plaza, which is about 2.5 blocks from where this happened.
Right, Dealey Plaza, the site of the JFK assassination. What can you tell us about the victims?
So I can confirm to you that 4 Dallas police officers and 1 DART officer, and DART is Dallas Area Rapid Transit, our public transportation system. Mm-hmm. So 5 officers total were killed, 7 officers and 2 civilians were wounded. And then 1 suspect has been identified as Micah Johnson, and he exchanged fire with police and was killed when a police robot detonated an explosive in a parking garage at a local community college where he had holed himself up in.
What about the condition of the survivors at this point?
I'm not sure at the moment. The hospitals aren't releasing a lot of information. Everything's coming through the Dallas Police Department.
There is a lot we don't know, obviously. What have you learned about the suspect, though?
We're hearing that he is from Mesquite, which is a suburb of Dallas. I believe he's 25 years old. There's some reports that say he had a military background. There's a lot of backgrounding that's still going on.
So a terrible traumatic experience for the city of Dallas. When you think about what comes next, how does it feel to be there right now?
I live in downtown Dallas, so just my neighborhood is shaken. People are posting on our local Facebook groups and our next door pages saying they're afraid to go outside. And downtown 10 years ago didn't have the residential population that it does now. So for this to happen in the heart of the city, in the heart of Dallas, has really shaken people to the core.
Hannah Wise of the Dallas Morning News, really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Today, Attorney General Loretta Lynch said it's been a week of heartbreak and loss for Americans. First, the police shootings of 2 African-American men in Baton Rouge and St. Paul, and then last night's shootings of police officers in Dallas.
Americans across our country are feeling a sense of helplessness, of uncertainty, and of fear. And these feelings are understandable, and they are justified. But the answer must not be violence. The answer is never violence.
Lynch said the answer is to take calm, peaceful, and determined action. Ijeoma Oluwa is editor of The Establishment, an online source of news and opinion. In the past few days, she's been vocal on Twitter about ways communities can hold the police accountable. She's here with us to talk about what you can do. So just first off, Ijeoma, how are you feeling after all the tragedies that have gone down this week?
I'm just shell-shocked, actually. I mean, it's one tragedy after the other, and I think I and many other people in many communities are just trying to hold it together and keep moving forward because this is an urgent situation to so many.
Was your Twitter advice, if we can call it that, was it a way for you to maybe cope with what's been going on?
Yes, it's really the only way I have to cope with what's going on. When things like this happen, what you hear so often, especially if you are a Black person or a person of color, you get condolences and you're reeling. You know, this happens time and time again that we see people who look just like us dying in the street. And what you hear time and time again is, I'm so sorry. I wish there was something I could do. I'm so sorry, but it seems hopeless. It seems helpless. And when you're already struggling with it, it's the last thing you want to hear. So really, you know, what all I could do was put together the steps that I knew that just about anybody with, you know, internet access or a phone could take to actually make a difference and try and get it out there.
Right. So it was about 14 or 15 tweets that you put out there. What are some of your recommendations?
My primary recommendations are to leverage the amount of power that you have in your local government. It is actually your local government that makes these decisions that determine whether or not police will be held accountable for their actions and whether or not policies are put in place to protect civilians. And, you know, on the local government level, we do have a lot more power than we think. And it's very simple because it can come down to your city council, where votes really do count on a level that we don't, you know, expect when we think about national elections. And so what I really wanted to do was show people where they could find the information they need to see what's happening in their town and to find the access to the representatives who are making these decisions so that they can leverage their power to ensure that these decisions will help ensure that their town is not next.
So give us an example. What is one recommendation that's especially practical, accessible, and, you know, that can make a difference?
You know, one thing I would definitely recommend is just Google your police accountability procedures for your city. And the things that you want to look for specifically are civilian oversight. Is there a civilian oversight panel and how much power do they have? If you cannot find that, you can easily just Google my city council and you'll find contact information for both city council and your mayor, and you can simply send an email. Most of them have links directly to your representatives. And you can send an email saying, what does my civilian oversight look like? Why don't I have civilian oversight? Body cameras are another thing to look for. Just Google your city's police force and whether or not they have body cameras. And if they do not, then that is another letter that you can write. That's another phone call you can make. And so, you know, the more you inform yourself, the more power you have.
Right. Ijeoma, you're in Seattle, right?
Yes.
Are these all measures that you've taken personally? And beyond these measures, what are you yourself doing to address and kind of protect yourself from these issues?
Yes, these are measures that I've been taking for a long time here in Seattle, and it's something I take very personally, especially because we are under federal decree here. We've already been found to be lacking in the way in which our police force treats people of color. And so, you know, we are incredibly aware of the risk to people of color at the hands of police here in Seattle. So I've been watching closely our attempts at reform and looking at the ways in which our laws are built here to make it almost impossible to prosecute police officers when they do shoot a unarmed person of color. Mm. And so I've been regularly in contact with the mayor's office and the city council. And we've been organizing calling drives and email drives to try and make sure that they know that this is not an issue that they can afford to ignore.
Tell me a bit about your background and how you became an activist.
I am a mother here in Seattle, a single mother of two children, and I became an activist actually out of need. I worked at a lucrative job in advertising actually for a long time, and as I started to see these babies dying in the street who looked so much like my son, Trayvon Martin was about the same age as my son, I knew I had to say something. And the more I spoke up, the more I was met with silence and indifference. And I just kept talking. I had to. It was life or death. I saw my brother in these boys. I see my son in these boys. And I knew that I could not afford to not say anything. And the more I spoke, the more I realized I couldn't stop speaking about it. And it became my life.
Your father, I gather, is from Nigeria, which has its own terrible history of police violence, especially in his time. Did he have any kind of advice or thoughts for you as you were going forward in this area of activism?
No, unfortunately, my father passed away quite some time ago. But I have a brother who grew up in Nigeria. And actually, last time he was here, we were stopped by the police. And he was absolutely appalled because, yes, there is rampant police misconduct and violence in Nigeria, but there's a system to it and you can expect it. You know that you will be stopped and you will be bribed, but they are not afraid of black men in Nigeria. That's a system of corruption and bribery. And here, the fact that he simply existed in his black skin could put him in danger was really shocking to him.
I'm curious, has your guidance for citizens about how to hold police accountable, has it felt tempered by what happened in Dallas last night and seeing police get killed as they were protecting people's right to protest?
No, I mean, it doesn't feel tempered. It feels threatened. I think that the work that we've all been doing feels very threatened because the amount of progress we've been able to make to get people to understand that we deserve to walk as free as everyone else, that progress was so slim. It was so, you know, it was barely there and it can be easily wiped away. And so I think we are all feeling very threatened by what happened, along with heartbroken and disgusted and angry that, you know, what was some progress. We had Dallas police officers marching with people, you know, and taking photos with people and doing what we've been asking for this whole time, which is recognize our basic humanity and our right to protection. And for that, they were shot. And it's absolutely heartbreaking. But all it does is, you know, strengthen my resolve, because the truth is the danger still out there. If anything, this is more dangerous for us now, because a lot of support that we had, we've just now seen wiped away with one horrific act.
As to that question, Ijeoma, next steps. I mean, there's a lot of understandable anger in this country over the shootings of black men by police. But recalling the words of the Dallas police chief that the police won't let a coward change this democracy, how are you planning to move forward?
You know, when we say that Black Lives Matter, it seems very controversial to some, but when you actually listen to the words, it's very simple. Do Black lives matter to you? And they matter to me, and that's not going to change. And I'm going to continue to work to make Black lives matter to more people and to make them matter to people in this state. So my mission does not change.
Ijeoma Oluo, editor of The Establishment, speaking with us from Seattle. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have a lot of information about increasing police accountability up on our Tumblr. We followed Ijeoma's advice and took a look at Boston, where we're based. You can see what we found at pritheworld.tumblr.com. Coming up, a look at two other countries dealing with police-related violence, Brazil and Kenya, on The World. When I look at what's happened here this week, the shootings of two black men in Baton Rouge and St. Paul at the hands of police, and the ambush of police officers in Dallas, it's hard not to think of the charged atmosphere in Brazil. In Rio de Janeiro, an estimated 15% to 20% of homicides are carried out by police. Killings of police are also on the rise in Rio, and now an elite police unit deployed specifically to pacify things prior to the Olympics in 2 weeks there, that unit has come under gunfire. Reporter Catherine Osborne is in Rio. We talked with her earlier this week about tracking gun violence in Rio in the weeks before the start of the Olympics. Let me start by asking you, what are Brazilians saying about the shootout in Dallas that has led to the deaths of policemen there?
They're definitely talking about it, and people are horrified. One comment that a journalist said to me was, you know, what did the U.S. think was going to happen when it had such loose gun control? Another comment is about media coverage of what's happening in the United States, specifically how Black Lives Matter has been able to successfully put this issue on the national conscience in a way that headlines around shootings earlier in the week said, even here in Brazil, U.S. police kill one more unarmed Black person. And someone who's a local journalism student posted about that and said, gee, you know, here when Black people are killed by the police, often if facts are unknown about them, they'll be called a suspect was shot or a criminal was shot. And so words that headlines use to describe this are definitely scrutinized and picked apart. And what's interesting is that the discussion from civil society at large about the issue of police killings and the war on drugs and who it affects racially has really developed, specifically because of exchanges that Brazilian activists have done with U.S. activists. There's growing awareness and outrage and pushes for reform based on the racial component of this in Brazil.
Let's get back to police violence in Rio. I mean, that elite police unit that came under gunfire earlier this week, would you consider that a kind of form of ambush or sniper activity, kind of what we saw in Dallas?
What's interesting is that for a long time, police in Rio have operated under a logic of territorial control and conflict with other organized crime groups here. So you have some neighborhoods that are in control and have been for a long time, not of the police, but of drug trafficking factions. And so violence in the city of Rio usually comes from an altercation after a crime, a robbery, or a territorial conflict. And so although race is a backdrop to all of this, pure racial hatred, I think, is too easy a explanation for what's going on. I think what most people blame for the way things are right now in Rio is the carelessness with which policing policies have been implemented. And what that means is there was a community policing program that was meant to de-escalate the way police interacted with poor communities. And essentially what's happened as the police have lost funding is that they've focused less on better interactions with communities and more on just taking over communities. And the time pressure of the Olympics has increased pressure on them to do that more quickly and to produce results. So essentially what you have is pressure to secure the city for this big event that's coming. And so currently we actually have over 15 territorial conflicts going on right now across the city of Rio.
Wow.
And yeah. So although race is a backdrop, it has to do more with real commitments to reform by public security officials and whether they actually believe in de-escalation or continuing combat-like strategies.
Yeah, hard to imagine how all that's going to get reformed in the next couple of weeks. I mean, the massive deployment of police pre-Olympics is pretty astounding. 85,000 officers, which is double what London took on for the Olympics there. How is that sheer number just amping up the tension between citizens and police?
People understand that they're being policed and surveilled. In addition to there being more officers on the street, police have the power and the army has the power to, for example, shut down cell service if a conflict happens. So there's an understanding in the population that there's a lot of social control, even more, far more than usual, in poor areas of the city. And folks are unhappy about it, but they're even more unhappy that after the games,
they're worried it'll be back to life as
usual.
Yeah,
they're worried that long term, there's not going to be a commitment to real improvements in safety for these neighborhoods. Many scholars have compared hosting the Olympics to waging a war in which you have to secure it. You have to push out populations that you view as dangerous. And then afterward, less care is given to people who live in that city.
What is the possibility that that spirit of global togetherness that the Olympics is supposed to foster will actually happen and will bring some relief to the violence in Rio and the Rio outside the Olympic Village?
What I think it'll be interesting to watch is, for some people, it's possible to live in a media world where you're going to watch the Olympics on TV or even come to the Olympics and have all sorts of great feelings about international togetherness. But I encourage people who are interested in the event to read more news about what's going on in the city more widely, and also what some of the consequences of the event are, and engaging with, for example, what local residents in Brazil think about issues in the U.S., like gun violence. That's also a really interesting possibility for international exchange that's beyond just sort of consuming a narrative that's going to be told to you if you come as a tourist.
And we'll be coming back to you for that reality check during the Olympics. Reporter Catherine Osborne in Rio de Janeiro, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
The newscast and today's headlines coming up next, but I just got to take a pause from all the headlines for a moment. As you know, we play a lot of music that is not from here on the show, but I recently got the posthumous release from the great New Orleans pianist and singer and composer Alan Toussaint. It's called American Tunes. Here's a taste of what feels like an appropriate song for today, his cover of American Tune by Paul Simon.
I don't know a soul who's not been battered. I don't have a friend who feels at ease. I don't know a dream that's not been shattered or driven to its knees. Oh, but it's all right. It's all right. For we've lived so well so long. Still, when I think of the road we're traveling on, I wonder what's gone wrong. I can't help it, I wonder what's gone wrong. And I dreamed I was dying. I dreamed that my soul rose unexpectedly, looking back down at me, smiled reassuringly. I dreamed I was flying high up above. My eyes could clearly see the Statue of Liberty sailing away to sea. Dreamed I was flying. But we come on a ship they call the Mayflower. We come on a ship that sailed the moon. We come in the ages.
The late Alan Toussaint with his rendition of American Tune. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman, and coming up on The World, what happens when someone who suffered trauma doesn't know what help is available?
Not having any information about post-traumatic stress or the symptoms that can occur after a trauma, they're confused and often think they're going crazy.
Sadly, he's talking there about inner-city youth in America. That story coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. I don't know about you, but this week has been relentless. It started with attacks in Bangladesh and Baghdad and ends now with the ambush of police officers in Dallas. Right in the middle, the police shootings of two African-American men, Alton Sterling in Baton Rouge and Philando Castile outside of St. Paul. Julia Nekesa Opoti hosts a radio show in Minnesota called Reflections of New Minnesotans. She says she was home last night when she heard about what happened in Dallas.
I got a call at 2 a.m. in the morning. Even though it had happened at 9 p.m. that night, it's just, you know, watching people's anger, watching people's shock, and with social media being what it is, seeing people react in that way in real time has been both very surreal but also traumatic, because it's revisiting so many experiences, but either personal or things that you've heard from people in the community.
Your radio show, Reflections of New Minnesotans, what community or communities do you converse with typically on the show?
So I mostly cover immigrants, and it's mostly immigrants of color. I don't know how much you know about Minnesota, but we have a large population of Somali, mm-hmm. Hmong, and then obviously Latin Americans. And so that's usually the biggest population that I cover. And not just the Hmong, but even Cambodians, Vietnamese.
Right.
We have new populations like the Karen from Southeast Asia.
So what have you been hearing from the people who listen to your show in Minneapolis? What's the discussion been like there the last couple of days?
There's something very striking that has with this particular case is, you know, oftentimes with immigrants not understanding the complexities of race and how racism plays out and police and relationships with the police, there's often been this disassociation from how racism plays out in policing. But now when they see someone who, you know, Philando Castile, who is the model citizen, you know, the person who is living the American dream that they imagine, especially as working class people or middle class people, it's sort of like hitting them that this could be me. We're hearing now that Castile had been pulled over for various reasons over 31 times. And one of the things that I keep hearing, especially from men of color, is how this is such a frequency for them. They sometimes never ended up in arrest, but they're often being pulled over. And so this is, you know, something that a routine traffic stop ends in someone's death is something that people are terrified about. They're talking about it, talking about praying for their extended family, their children. So there seems to be a relieving of that trauma of being constantly policed.
And is that a trauma these new arrivals bring with them from wherever they came from?
I think it's a mix. I think the immigrant population in Minnesota is also unique because a lot of the populations I mentioned are refugees. So they are specifically fleeing persecution of some kind. And so the idea that they've come to a safer place is sort of surreal for them to imagine then again that, you know, American police are supposed to be safe, they're supposed to be protecting them. And then to hear this happen, you know, people are relieving that.
Julia, you're originally from Kenya, but you've been in the States for a couple of decades now. We're going to be speaking with our correspondent in Nairobi, where there's also been a lot of police violence lately with seeming impunity. So you, as a Kenyan in America, are you following this trend on two continents? And what's that been like for you?
Oh, my goodness. I have this really difficult. There's a lot of things I think about, like the impunity with which police exist, you know, whether it's in Kenya or here, the parallel between the two. It's not something, there's no reconciliation between the two, but I just permanently reading one terror story after another, you know.
Julia Nekesa Opoti, host of the radio program Reflections of New Minnesotans Out of the Twin Cities. Thank you very much for your thoughts today, Julia.
Thank you.
If you were to go to Kenya's capital, Nairobi, chances are you'd find a lot of people who sadly relate to some of the violence in the U.S. You'd find people with T-shirts that say, "Stop Police Executions." Kenya has been reeling from a spate of police violence lately. I've got my BBC colleague Tommy Oladipo with me from Nairobi.
Kenya has known or had a history of, you know, reports of extrajudicial killings by the police of civilians, but they've not really come to the limelight until about last week or the week before, when a lawyer and two of his counterparts were killed. They had brought a case against a police officer, and it's believed that this was what resulted in their killing. It's still not clear, and the case is in court, but there have been protests about this, and this has now been a platform for people to talk about all the other cases of killings where police target people, particularly in slum areas.
When it comes to the deaths of the actual people, I mean, is there a trend to these killings? Is there a racial or ethnic component? Is it class?
It appears to be mostly in the slum areas where you have the shanty towns, where you've got the poorest people in the cities. That's where you hear a lot of these cases. But there have also been cases of disappearances. There's been a number of terror attacks here in Kenya, and it's believed that as the security forces go on their counterterrorism campaigns and go into predominantly Muslim neighborhoods, several Muslim, particularly young men, have disappeared and have been killed. There have been high-profile Muslim clerics as well who've been killed, believed to have been killed by the police. You know, they're not brought before the courts, and that's what a lot of campaigners are complaining about.
Have any police been killed in all of this?
Well, there have been cases, particularly where you have, you know, criminal gangs facing off against the police. So, yes, there have been cases of casualties in that regard. But it's predominantly those people who the police confront that are recorded as killed.
How about the prosecutions? Have Kenyan police been prosecuted in any of these cases?
Generally, you rarely hear of police being prosecuted for extrajudicial killings. In fact, what you do have is a process of police reforms to reform the entire police force right from, the bottom to the top and see how they can make the police work as a better force. But even the president has complained that this process has been going too slowly. So it's not just, the average Kenyan on the street that has been complaining about the police, but even the president, the man at the top.
How do ordinary Kenyans view their police in terms of trust?
There is a general apprehension when it comes to police in Kenya. People do not completely trust their police. They fear them. So it's been a long time because there's been this kind of distance. The police have this slogan that says police is your friend. But a lot of Kenyans feel like the police is not their friend because even on the streets, if you're going through traffic, police stop you and people believe that the police want bribes. But there have been changes made within the police. There have been reforms in the police to prevent corruption because people generally see the police as corrupt and heavy-handed. So there have been efforts made, but people still have a bit of mistrust. So it will take some time before people are able to trust the police here in Kenya. I guess they just need to see solid evidence that they can work together with the police.
Finally, Tommy, what was the reaction in Kenya, as far as you've heard, to the police violence here in the U.S. against black men especially, but also the apparent reaction to the violence from those attackers or attacker on the Dallas police last night?
Just like in any other part of the world, the Kenyans are following these cases in the U.S. closely, and there is certainly a lot of shock, but also a lot of solidarity for the African American community. You tend to see that in social media, people wondering why these kinds of cases are happening and wondering if America is truly the kind of place it's portrayed to be, because a lot of people here look up to the US. It's a place that people want to go to, but when they hear these kinds of stories, they then get disheartened. People seem disturbed when you talk to them about these cases.
My BBC colleague Tommy Oladipo in Nairobi. Thank you, Tommy.
You're welcome.
The level of gun violence in the United States is something that many people around the world find puzzling and disturbing. Chelsea Parsons focuses on guns and crime policy at the Center for American Progress. She advocates for laws and policies at the federal, state, and local levels to prevent gun violence. This week, the nation has been rocked by all this stuff that you look at, Chelsea. Some involve the deaths of African Americans in the hands of police. And last night, 5 police officers in Dallas killed by civilians in a kind of sniper style. How would you explain this to someone from outside the U.S. who's just shaking their head and asking why?
Frankly, many of us in the United States continue to shake our heads and ask why. The levels of gun violence that we experience in the United States are unmatched by any of our peer nations around the country. The gun murder rate in this country is 25 times higher than our peer nations. And so there's a lot of work to do. And we really need to get much more serious about getting at the root of what is going on and what's causing this violence and how can we improve our laws and our policies to reduce the number of people who are killed in this country with firearms.
If you're looking at causes and the roots of the root of this violence, look at this past week. Do you see a common thread in the gun deaths this week?
One of the common threads really that you see, and it's important to note that we often talk about gun violence in this country in the context of the kind of shooting or the kind of incident that is so extreme and so outrageous that it draws national attention. But, it's important to remember that, 91 people are killed with guns in this country every day. And much of what drives that violence is simply easy access to firearms. Certainly, guns themselves don't cause violence, but guns in the wrong hands are often what turns interpersonal altercations into lethal altercations. So that's really why, in the wake of many of these incidents, we return our focus to the firearms and to the laws in this country that allow easy access to firearms and to highly dangerous weapons of war.
Is there any country where there's been evidence that laws regulating guns led to not only a decrease in gun violence among citizens, but also a decrease in police shootings?
You can even look at the experience of different states within our country to see that stronger laws that help reduce easy access to firearms by people who we agree shouldn't have them, stronger laws that reduce access to highly dangerous weapons that have the ability to kill many, many people in a very short period of time, have an impact at reducing the number of gun deaths in that state.
What state has that happened in?
So two states, the experience of Connecticut and the experience of Missouri. Connecticut passed a law requiring a background check and more strict evaluation before a person is allowed to buy a handgun. After that law was passed, handgun murders went down in the state. Missouri took the exact opposite approach. It eliminated a background check requirement for the purchase of handguns, and gun murders went up after that happened. And there are other examples of this. We did a study a few years ago here at the Center for American Progress where we found that the 10 states with the weakest gun laws have an aggregate level of gun violence that's more than twice as high than the 10 states with the strongest gun laws. Oh. And so while there's not a clear direct causation, there's certainly a correlation between having stronger laws relating to firearms and lower rates of gun violence.
Let me just go back to that question I asked earlier, and we kind of talked about states in the U.S., but what about countries where laws regulating guns led to a decrease in police shootings?
I can't speak to that. I don't know that there has been that kind of study. I think that one of the things that I would point out is that not only is the United States an outlier when it comes to gun homicides, which I mentioned before, but the United States is an outlier when it comes to the rate at which police officers have fatal encounters with members of the community. So The Guardian has been tracking police-related fatalities over the last year and a half.
And the Guardian newspaper.
The Guardian newspaper, yeah. Correct. And they released what I think is a really stunning comparison point last year, which was that in England and Wales, there were 55 fatal police shootings in the last 24 years. In the first 24 days of 2015 in the United States, there were 59 fatal police shootings.
Yeah, that's pretty stark.
Firearm ownership among private citizens in the United States is extremely high. It's very hard to estimate, but I think a fair estimate is that there are 300 million guns in private hands in this country. One of the trends we have seen is that the number of households in the United States that own guns has been going down, but the concentration of firearms within a smaller group of households has been going up.
And those numbers are of legally held firearms, is that correct?
Correct. And again, it's also worth noting that we have really limited data on private firearm ownership in this country because of efforts by the gun lobby to really restrict the ability of the federal government to be able to keep data and keep information about firearms ownership in this country.
Chelsea Parsons focuses on guns and crime policy at the Center for American Progress. Thank you.
Thank you.
If the news has you down, stick around for some self-care advice here on The World. After a week like this, some people I know say they're tuning out. No more news for them. Believe me, I get that. People do need to take care of themselves. But how do you actually take care of yourself in traumatic situations? There's a program in Philadelphia that helps inner-city residents after they've experienced trauma. It's called Healing Hurt People. Dr. John Rich co-directs the program.
Well, many of the young people that we see in Healing Hurt People have experienced direct physical violence. They've been shot, they've been stabbed, or assaulted. And that in itself can activate lots of physical activities, physical responses, and also psychological symptoms like nightmares, flashbacks, and feeling really unsafe in the world. The truth is that many of these young people already live in neighborhoods that are constantly unsafe in their estimation. That is, they often hear gunshots, they may see other people injured, and they have a deep sense that the police are not there to protect them. And so these young people come in with full-blown post-traumatic stress, very much the same as we might see in people returning from war or combat.
So what do you tell them? How do you work with that?
Well, first, we have to help young people understand what is happening, because they, not having any information about post-traumatic stress or the symptoms that can occur after a trauma, they're confused and often think they're going crazy. And that is something that often communities feel, as though we're all going crazy. There's so much dangerous stuff happening around us. So first, understanding that these are in themselves a kind of normal manifestation of the body's fight or flight mechanism that's gone haywire because of the extreme trauma. So just understanding what the symptoms mean can give people a better sense that these are there for the period of time after the trauma and they'll recede, and that in the meantime, it's really important for all of them and for us to take care of ourselves in very specific ways.
Like what? How would you tell people to take care of themselves when they're in a traumatic kind of state of mind?
Well, we encourage young people who have been injured to develop what we call a safety plan. A safety plan is a list of activities that you can do, some by yourself and some with other people, in case you feel stress and trauma welling up within you. And it's pretty individual. For some people, it may be deep breathing and meditation. For others, it could be prayer. For some people, it's really listening to music or other soothing activities like yoga or physical activity. Having those prepared in advance means that when young people encounter a situation that's causing them stress, they have something ready to turn to, literally a piece of paper, a laminated card that they carry in their pockets that they can pull out and use and activate in the moment.
John, talk to us also about secondary trauma. I mean, many of us, fortunately, have not experienced firsthand what the partners of Philando Castile or Alton Sterling have, but I know a lot of people who have watched those videos follow the news. They're in shock. Some of them are literally sick to their stomach, some so ill they're calling in sick to work. What do you say to people who are feeling this?
Well, it's important to know that that is a normal phenomenon. Traumatic stress doesn't only affect people who have been directly injured or traumatized, but often affects people who have witnessed the trauma or folks who have heard about the trauma or family members. So it's normal that we should feel some of the trauma associated with watching these devastating and traumatic videos and hearing those stories. Part of self-care, though, is to make sure that we're not overexposing ourselves to those images, which can be traumatizing. And to, especially for children who are going to have more difficulty making sense of those images, to limit their contact.
So slow down on the consumption of those videos. What about checking out of the news completely? Is that healthy? Because I know some people who find it very useful.
I would suggest that each person needs to make a decision about how that's affecting them. For people who've experienced past trauma, these kinds of recurrent trauma, even indirectly, can serve as powerful triggers. So for people who've experienced significant stress and trauma, it's especially important that they think very carefully about how much of this news they consume in its most graphic forms, but they're intentionally working to process that information with other people in their communities. And again, for children, if parents have children who are being exposed to this through social media or through television, it's critically important to experience that with children if they're going to be exposed to it at all, to limit it, and then to spend time processing what this means, what it means for the world and community, but also reinforcing to children that adults and parents are there in their lives to keep them safe. And then we often tell parents to keep an eye on children in these times. And if you see behavioral changes or children who seem to have regressed a little bit to an earlier age or to behaviors of an earlier age, that you take that seriously and consult with your pediatrician to make sure that you're providing the kinds of reassurance to your child that the child needs.
Dr. John Rich with Healing Hurt People in Philadelphia. Thank you very much for your time today.
It's my pleasure.
A lot to think about: how to stop gun violence, how we can heal as a society, as a global nation. Dr. Rich suggested that music might be one of those safety plans, and I'm hoping the Satchel Ensemble may help. They're from Pakistan, and as they were getting ready to record their latest batch of songs, they turned to tunes that express universal ideas of love and hope. One of them, this classic by Stevie Wonder. For their version, the Satchel Ensemble got Jim James from My Morning Jacket to handle the vocals. We'll leave you with their take on Love's in Need of Love today. from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. Everyone, make it a peaceful weekend. Thank you.
All to everybody, what I'm about to say could mean the world's disaster, could change your joy and laughter to tears and pain. It's that love's in need of love. Of evil plans to make you its possession, and it will if we let it.
PRI, Public Radio International.